It's time for Skin in the Game, and we have your front row seat to the action with marketing expert John Simperman and sports business journalist Tim Oshai.
They're talking about a $1 billion renovation.
Which is incredible.
And that's
for a hockey arena in the South, right?
But that includes hotels.
Skin in the Game brings you the fresh and fascinating business news in the world of sports, a multi-billion dollar industry that has an economic impact on all of us.
This week, veteran New York Times business and NFL reporter Ken Belson joins us to talk about the future of the NFL and his latest book, Every Day is Sunday.
Sports as an asset class is a phrase I never would have used 5 years ago, but when teams are going for $6 billion, they can't help but not be assets. You're losing a little bit of the football fabric that made the league, you know, sort of fun to cover, but also unique.
Coming up next on Skin in the Game, right after this.
Listen to BTPM NPR wherever you are on the BTPM Listen app. Find it in the Google Play Store and the Apple App Store.
Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. This is your co-host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim Oshai. And we, John, are bringing in a writer today.
Well, I love when you bring in writers.
Thank you. I do too, being one.
You know, oftentimes, though, I don't get a word in edgewise.
I'm going to be quiet. Sorry, no. No. I'm not going to be quiet. I'm going to be quieter today. I'll limit my writing questions.
So before we get to the background on our guest, Ken Belson, I did want to talk a little bit about what I think, and to our listeners in Southern Ontario and beyond, I think was in my mind one of the most memorable, emotional World Series contests that I've ever experienced, and I've been to a few Game Sevens, but this was one for the ages.
It was, and I we're of course talking about the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Toronto Blue Jays. My sympathies to the Blue Jays fans out there. I was with you. Mm. Were you?
I was, absolutely.
Yeah.
Blue Jays.
John's a longtime Los Angeles resident, so
I had to ask. But Blue Jays were a client of mine for at least 7 years. Still have many, many friends, not only in the GTA, but still working for the Blue Jays organization. Yes, I was pulling for them. And, you know, our show here is based in Western New York, so we're the AAA home of the Blue Jays, and a lot of talent that came out of the Buffalo farm system was playing on the big stage in Toronto and LA.
Of course, in our home station here, in NPR's Buffalo Toronto Public Media is, of course, a Toronto station. So yeah, that was kind of a home World Series for us in many ways. But you talk about the emotion. This I can say, and there's a little bit of this as being a sports writer, and some of this is enjoying baseball as a sport more than baseball teams as a fan. I found myself like gripping the seat and gripping my knee watching that Game 7, and some of the other games too. It wasn't just Game 7, but especially that Game 7.
Yeah.
That World Series contest really, I think, more than anything I've seen in quite some time, any series I've seen, captured the drama of sports.
Right.
And I think it helps that you had one of the biggest cities in the United States of America, Los Angeles, playing Canada's number one city, Toronto, at a time when there's some tensions between the countries, but especially if you're Canadian, the sense of Canadian pride is incredibly high. And I feel like that played into it.
Absolutely. And we do not get into X's and O's here on Skin in the Game. We're really focused on the business of sport and how it impacts our economy, our culture. But you brought up a point, and then you ask, people ask, why do sports TV ratings and revenues continue to rise? Because it's the live drama, right? You have to be there. That's the moment. You know, there's the whole FOMO, fear of missing out. And, you know, if you missed out, unfortunately, you missed out on some incredible emotional drama. But guess what? Not everyone, but the numbers were there to back it up. 26 million U.S. viewers. The Canadian numbers as of this recording are still not in, but estimated to be above 8 million. You know, those are the highest TV ratings for World Series since 2017. both nations caught on to the excitement and the drama. And you brought up two big markets. Major League Baseball, believe it or not, and the networks, believe it or not, really don't like it when a Canadian team is in the World Series.
I know, and I don't feel bad for them at all. I'm glad. I'm glad they had to deal with it.
And here's why, because it's not a U.S. metered market, and usually you get the draw from both of those big cities. But that was dispelled here because there was drama, there was talent, there was a story, so that was awesome. I hope all of our friends in Toronto are doing fine, and I hope that they're all back, you know, next year as strong as ever. So kudos to the players, the fans, and the organizations to putting on a tremendous show. Switching gears to football, because it's always football, and every day is Sunday. Before we get to our guest, could you give a little background on our guest and what we hope to chat about?
Yeah, sure thing. About a month ago, I got an email from a guy named Ken Belson. A guy named Ken Belson, whose name I know and you know from the New York Times. Ken is a longtime business and sports business, and particularly NFL business reporter for the New York Times. And he wrote a book that dropped last month in October called Every Day is Sunday: How Jerry Jones, Robert Kraft, and Roger Goodell Turned the NFL into a Cultural and Economic Juggernaut. And yes, it sure is that.
Yes, they did. It will be interesting to dig into conversation with Ken and just, you know, what were those milestone moments that, you know, occurred over the last 30 years that really created this phenomenon, really, in many ways, that's now growing internationally and who knows where it'll stop. So really looking forward. I want to thank you for bringing Ken on the show. I want to thank Ken for spending some time with us. So please stay tuned for our guest, Ken Belson, the author of Every Day is Sunday.
Listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media, The Bridge, wherever you are. Search for the BTPM Listen app on all your devices.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Skin in the Game. Joining us is New York Times writer Ken Belson, author of Every Day is Sunday. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
You got it. Every Day is Sunday is a great book. Loved reading. I've been telling John that I've been reading it for the last few weeks. And as a writer, it's one of those books where I read it and say, I wish I wrote it. When did you know that you wanted to tell this story? When did you know you wanted to write this book?
Well, I had a mind to write a book. I actually pitched a book around 2015-16. I was about 3 years on the beat, the business of the NFL beat at that point. But to be honest, the proposal was different and it didn't have much traction. And frankly, I wasn't prepared. I didn't have the depth. I didn't know the owners as well. I hadn't seen the range of things that go on in the NFL that I've since seen. By the time I pitched the book in 2022, I'd been on the beat almost a decade. So I had seen Deflategate, the Ray Rice issue. I covered, I don't know, 10 drafts. I've been to a dozen Super Bowls. I'd seen such a variety, COVID, Kaepernick. There were so many sort of touchstone issues. And then I just knew the owners much better to the point where I felt like if I was going to write a book and I was going to reapproach them, for longer interviews, I'd have much better success. I had to get smarter, if that's the right word. I had to sort of be more master of the material. That light went on around 22.
And hey, Ken, thanks for joining. This is John Semperman. So you said you got to know the owners well over the years. And how's the reaction from the ownership group and from the league been?
I haven't heard from the league. Frankly, I haven't asked. The owners were very generous with their time, the ones that I spoke to. I didn't speak to all 32. There was no point in doing that. I spoke to probably almost half of them by the end. Some of the owners are just not very engaged. Jody Allen in Seattle, good luck trying to get to her. You know, some of the new owners, Josh Harris, Greg Penner in Denver, you know, they didn't really have much. I mean, they've just only been in the league a couple of years. So when you really boil it down, it's Jerry and Robert, it's Clark Hunt, Art Rooney, John Mara, a lot of the quote-unquote usual suspects, you know, the guys who do, frankly, the bulk of the work in the ownership circle. Shad Khan's another one. And so those are the ones I focused on. I wasn't going to, it wasn't an attendance test to just get everybody on the record. That wasn't worth my time.
One of the things I love about the book, Ken, is, I mean, you really, and I say this as somebody who's written a lot about the NFL, where we sit here in Buffalo, you do such a great job, not only capturing the inner workings of the league, but the, you know, the characters. Sitting and reading the book, you really feel like you start to get to know these owners as people. And I know that's part of the goal. But I have a couple of questions for you on it. To start, you focus obviously on Robert Kraft, Jerry Jones, and of course, Roger Goodell. How natural a choice was it to put the lens of the book, you know, most tightly on those three?
Well, my instinct was to add more, to have a Mount Rushmore with, you know, a dozen people, but that's unwieldy. If you're trying to write a book for non-football people, which was part of my goal, you really have to make it easier for people. Like, you know, once you start going to the second tier of owners, no offense to them, you lose people. So I particularly focused on Jerry and Robert, not just because they have the two most valuable teams and have won 9 Super Bowls between them and all that, but they both got involved at a key point in the history of the league in the early 90s when, you know, frankly, the league was not anything near what it is today. Teams were still losing money. The networks weren't the juggernaut. The media money was not the gusher that it is today. And both of them had a really strong hand in reshaping the league. I guess you would sort of say supersizing or turbocharging the revenue model. Both of them were very involved with it. So, you know, from the business perspective, and that's really where I came from, they were the natural choices. And then Roger, you know, I could have chosen Paul. Paul certainly is a big feature in the early parts of the book. But Paul's been out for almost 20 years, so you know, it didn't make sense to put two contemporary owners and a historical figure. So it made sense to just go with Roger. And also just, you know, it's a bit of a contemporary history, you know, it reaches back to 30 years, but really I'm trying to bring people to the present and that's Roger. So.
Right, right. And Ken, you know, the word that you used or use when describing this book is, you know, how this has become an immensely profitable American religion. And Tim and I here on this program, we do talk about sports being that religion is a place that people from all backgrounds can come together, hopefully, you know, the tribal instincts in a positive way. And it is one of those few things that being professional sports that bring it together. But for our listeners, they all need to read the book, obviously. But what was that? Is there a moment in time, and you said over the last 30 years, where this league really turned the corner?
Well, 93, you know, was a big moment in the league. And if you think back to 1920 when it started, well, 1958 was a big year. The first overtime game between the Colts and Giants championship game. 1961, they get antitrust exemption to cut media deals. 93 was huge. There were player strikes. There were, you know, fears of future work stoppages. The media, the company CBS, NBC didn't want to put in as much money because they were afraid of losing games. You know, the league was kind of a little bit in shambles. So 93, they get free agency, they get the salary cap. And then really the big thing from the business side is they get revenue sharing. The players are now partners. Gene Upshaw, the union chief, literally walks out of the room, tells the reporters, we're now partners. So suddenly the owners had carte blanche to start investing in the league, and the players were cheering them on. They were going to get half of that money, and that would go towards the payroll, so the player payroll. So that was a big moment. And then I would say 2001, you know, post 9/11, Patriots winning in an upset, and Robert Kraft saying we're all Patriots. That was kind of a touchstone moment. And then after that, I would say in a different way, the lockout in 2011. Not necessarily because they got through it, and they did. They only missed, I think, only the Hall of Fame game, something like that. But they, and then this is a little bit geeky, but they extended the labor deals to 10 years. And once you go to 10 years and you know you have that certainty, the media then said, oh, well, let's do 10 years. Let's do Fox, CBS, etc. And then they were like, well, if you're going to give us 10 years, we're going to pay a lot more. And so the money really exploded in 2011, and then they signed another 10-year deal in 2020. So that's very untraditional in union deals. Usually do shorter deals, but going to 10 was like the foundation. Okay, we have a stable business going and people invest in that. So yeah, I would say those are the three key dates, 93, 01, and then 2011.
Something that jumped out at me was the impact that Rupert Murdoch has had on the NFL. And I hate to say not a lot of people know it. I think it might be fair to say when people think of Rupert Murdoch and Fox News, they may not be thinking about the impact that Fox and the deal that Murdoch made with the NFL so many decades ago had the impact that it did. Can you, Ken, tell people a little bit about that for folks who haven't read the book yet, and then we'll dig in a little.
You're absolutely right. There is a through line from sports to the build out of the Fox network and then Fox News, and then we can keep going from there. I'm sure plenty of people smarter than me have written about it. But Rupert Murdoch and the Fox network were basically nowhere prior to the NFL. They were on UHF channels. They didn't have broad distribution. Most people remember them for In Living Color and The Simpsons. They didn't have a news division. They certainly didn't have a sports division. So they were kind of an up-and-comer, kind of a bit of a wannabe. And in major markets, they couldn't crack through and get the right affiliates to get the best distribution. And Rupert Murdoch had learned in England when he got the first rights to the English Premier League that people will pay up for sports. And once you have them there, you can do a lot of other things. And so he had tried twice to get into the NFL, and Pete Rozelle and then later Taglib, who didn't really take him seriously. But it was Jerry Jones. And going back to the earlier discussion about why Robert, why Jerry, Jerry looked around. He was a new owner, that relatively new owner. And he said, wait a second, we've got three bidders for three packages. Like, who runs a business like that? Why don't we get an auction going? I know a fourth guy. Rupert comes back in and he actually tells Rupert, you're not a stalking horse. We're going to take you seriously, even though you have no sports division. And they bring in a guy, David Hill from England, who had been doing the soccer programming. And he has like a sizzle reel and he shows the owners, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a more bombastic talk show to run into the game before the games. I'm going to have the Fox box. I'm going to have more cameras on the game, more audio. So you'll hear like the shoulder pads hitting the other shoulder pads. And they were like, wow, okay, that's a new model. And so they really took a leap of faith, and Rupert Murdoch overpaid dramatically for the package and won it. You know, if you think about it as a business risk, they were taking his money and they had no sports division. Zero. They had no theme song. They had no anchors. They had nothing. Well, as it turned out, CBS was out of the football business and they hired all the CBS guys. And wouldn't you know it, all the affiliates, the CBS affiliates, which used to have NFC games, said, you know what, we're switching over to Fox. So Rupert, in one fell swoop, got sports, and then he got all the affiliates to give a truly national network. And from there, 2 years later, he launches, or 3 years later, he launches Fox News. And that was really the inflection point for many, many things in our country. But for him, he was very shrewd that way. And CBS, by the way, learned its lesson, can't do without the NFL. And it was Robert Kraft, now on the media committee, who brought them back for the lesser AFC package at twice the price.
It's crazy to think about that, that they didn't have a network. They didn't have any sportscasters. It looks like they were adding a lot of sizzle to the steak.
Yes.
And if you look at today's broadcast, you look at how in some cases the entertainment even drives more than the game itself. You know, a lot of that probably dates back to those meetings they had with Fox.
You know, you think we take it all for granted, but, you know, that sort of clubby, almost frat boy atmosphere with Howie Long and Terry Bradshaw and Jimmy, those guys have been there for the duration. That was new. You used to have Brent Musburger and Phyllis George, and it was very kind of staid, like a newscast.
Well, you forgot Jimmy the Greek too, right?
Jimmy the Greek, right? Well, that was the wink and the nod back in the day. But you know, it felt like a newscast, and they were kind of stentorian. And now you've got these guys just BSing the way you would around your sofa in your living room, you know. And that was novel back then. Yeah, there were a lot of innovations that Fox brought in that are now very much the same. And also the music. As David Hill, the producer, he said, I want Batman on steroids. Mm. And now every time I see that robot thing jumping around on the Fox broadcast, I think of Batman on steroids. Right. They pushed the envelope and it worked.
Yeah, well, they pushed the envelope. And, you know, it was probably the what predates, you know, ESPN College Game Day and now Fox Big Sunday. But, you know, it all started back there with those first Fox Sports broadcasts.
I'm going to indulge me a writer question here, Ken. I, you know, when people read the book, they'll see this, that this is a narrative nonfiction book, John. So you're going to feel like you're there. It feel, you know, it reads a bit like a novel at times, but the level of detail is incredible. So what I'm curious about is, from the owners on down, did you find that people were willing? You addressed the owners a little bit ago, you know, to a point, but did you find people were willing to open up? And the NFL is a powerful organization. Did you run into people who were, I guess, lack of a better way to put it, fearful of, in revealing too much or going too far in their comments?
Actually, the reverse. If I call owners, not just owners, but people at the networks and all the other places, I mean, I'm partly, they'll take my call partly on reputation. They've dealt with me, and partly it's the New York Times, and we have a certain standard that we try and uphold. But the book was very different, and I had a much easier time getting them to talk, because it's, in some ways, it's their legacy, right? It's history to them, you know, and they all want to say they took part and did this and did that. And then while I was there, I could talk to them about contemporary issues, whatever they were, the Dan Snyder fiasco, you name it. So I found it actually almost liberating. There were quite a few owners who gave me multiple hours. One owner, this is Shad Khan, I flew down to Jacksonville. He sat in his office for 4 hours. You know, I mean, you never get that access for a regular news story. And I think they wanted to fill in the painting with me. And of course, as I went along, and this is sort of a, it's not a novel trick or anything, but as you do more interviews, you have more stuff to ask. So, hey, John Mara told me that at this meeting, this happened. Is that the way you remember it? And so you start to triangulate episodes as you go along. And that was the fun part. There are certain episodes, the one that starts the chapter on relocation, where Art Modell is being wheeled out of a hotel in a laundry basket. I must have interviewed 12 people about that. It's such a bizarre, funny, descriptive little moment that I was tipped off by another reporter who had been at that meeting, you know, in 1996. So I was not there. So that was the fun part. And some owners were like, you know, I do remember that. That was kind of a weird thing. So jogging people's memory was fun too. And after a while, you're like, you have all the same reference points. There was one about Jerry Jones starting the chapter on the labor negotiations, where he describes owls and chickens having sex.
It was a memorable moment in the book, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. I won't give it all away. But Jerry has this sort of soliloquy in an owner's meeting at labor talks. And I asked John Mara about it. Do you remember when Jerry said this? He said he used to say that all the time. So there were a lot of sort of fun moments where they were kidding each other. And I enjoyed sort of getting a little bit inside that circle.
I want to ask you about a chapter, and I'm going to read the title for folks. It's A High School Cafeteria for Billionaires. And that High School Cafeteria for Billionaires is you describing in great detail the owners and the owners' meetings and the way that these, you know, 32 ownership owners or ownership groups, in the case of Green Bay, interact with each other. And it's absolutely fascinating. I'd love to get your perspective on this. You know, in a high school cafeteria, you've got your cliques, and you write about that. And you've got, you know, some owners who are kind of on the outside. And, you know, you mentioned that, you know, Mike Brown in Cincinnati is one of those. Ralph Wilson, the late founder of the Buffalo Bills, seemed to be one of those. How much did market size and or team success, those can be two different things, relate to how these guys in the room related to each other?
I literally just tried to visualize or describe where do they sit in these executive sessions at their quarterly meetings. And in fact, yeah, it seems like it felt like a high school cafeteria, because Al Davis and Alex Spanos in San Diego, they were just buddies, and they always sat together off in the corner, like the kids snickering about, you know, the teacher at the front of the room. And Jerry, being Jerry, is right in the middle near the microphone. And then there's Mike Brown. There's, you know, he's always a wild card, and he kind of sat off in the corner. And the Rooneys and the Maras and the McCaskies, the sort of Irish, multi-generational Irish-American families, they sat together. So I had kind of fun with that. And the premise of it was just like, this is who they are. They're like as cliquey and friendly and frenemy as the rest of us, except that they have these multi-billion-dollar assets. So I just sort of had fun with it. In answer to your question, it's not so much where they sit. But when you, as an owner, win a Super Bowl, you rise like a whole rank. It's like going from captain to major, or major to colonel, or getting a star and being a general. Like, everybody wants to know how you crack the code. And, you know, some guys are wear it on their sleeves and will happily tell you. I mean, this is how Robert Kraft, he was already an active and, I guess, respected owner. But the minute he starts winning Super Bowls in the 21st century, oh my God. And then after a while, after the third one, it's like, okay, Robert, now we're jealous. And we're starting to resent you. You know, there's then just like a cafeteria, right? Jerry won frequently and early, but not after. And then some owners never win, and they're always just on the outside trying to figure out like how they do it. You definitely get status as a winning club. It doesn't have anything to do with your business acumen. It just means like you have what everybody else covets. And there's that anecdote in there about Shad Khan. He sits right in the front, in the middle row, right in front of the dais where Goodell is. And he sits across from Kraft and just a couple of seats over from Jerry Jones. And when he bought the club, Wayne Weaver, the previous owner, said, keep the seat. Never give up that seat. And Shad didn't understand what it meant. But what he realized later was, oh, you're Jacksonville. You're the smallest or one of the smallest markets. And you will learn a lot by being near Robert and Jerry. And Shad realized, oh, actually, that is smart to be near them. You'll see how business is done in the league literally by proximity.
Ken, I love that high school cafeteria analogy. Is it safe to say that those at Al Davis's table were starting the food fights? Is that correct to say?
There's a spicy anecdote about Al and his president, Amy Trast. Amy was great, by the way. She had fun with me over coffee, describing the tone in the room and the quiet F-bombs on the side that were dropped by various people. And Al was a growler, and he wanted to sit in the back and read the room like, you know, George C. Scott and Patton or something. He was a very colorful guy, and unfortunately I didn't cover him, but a friend of mine who used to cover the league in the 90s said, you know, Paul Tagliabue used to have his press conference, and down the hall Al Davis would have the alternative press conference, and you had to cover both because Al was such a great character. The league kind of misses people like that, or at least I feel they do. They're far fewer flamboyant owners. Jerry's one of the rare exceptions, frankly.
You're yeah. telling us Terry Pegula is no Al Davis?
Terry's kind of a, you know, let me just be a little clinical here. There's basically three sets of owners. There's the owners that are, you know, obviously run their teams, but are also very active in league business on the media committee, the finance committee, and all the other league business. On the other end, the owners that you rarely see much of, I mentioned Jody Allen being one of them. And then there's a lot of sort of owners that just kind of help and are on committees, but aren't super active. They're usually not the chair people of those committees. And I would say Terry's somewhere in the middle in terms of his activity or his interest level. And everybody has other businesses and other things. I mean, he has another team and the hockey team. So everybody chooses how much they want to get involved. But, you know, if I had to think of the 10, it would be Robert and Jerry, Shad Khan, Clark Hunt, the Rooney and Mara. That's like 6, 7 right there. Bidwill is also very involved. Jed York in San Francisco. Jimmy Haslam's another in Cleveland. And then there's owners like Mike Brown. He's just, you know, his daughter is involved, but Mike's, you know, he shows up to one or two meetings a year. He's usually the one vote who votes against everything. Yeah, but I'd say Terry's somewhere in the middle. He usually votes with Jerry on issues, but he's not going to be a chairman of a committee. It's just not his, what he wants to do.
Yeah, not his style. Not his style.
We're here with Ken Belson, author of Every Day is Sunday. And Ken, you brought up kind of how the league, and I think this goes beyond the NFL, you know, how we're losing some of those Charlie O'Finleys, those Al Davises, the Bill Vecs, dating ourselves. But
yeah,
we're seeing more and more private equity getting into the ownership group. You know, how do you think that's going to play out long term? And are we going to lose more of those, I just don't want to say characters, I'm even say fabric of the communities that they serve or that they call home?
Yeah, it's a good point. And it, frankly, it's not just the NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, and Major League Soccer. They're all taking private equity money. There's a quote at the very beginning of the book where I mention, it's not my quote, but I cite a quote where a person says, The NFL under Pete Rozelle was Madison Avenue. It was advertising and marketing. Under Paul Tagliabue, it was Wall Street. It was financial footing, you know, the revenue sharing I mentioned. And under Roger Goodell, it's Hollywood slash Broadway. It's a media company. I would read that quote to NFL people, you know, former executives and so on. One of them said to me, no, Roger is not Hollywood. Roger is a hedge fund. He's into financial engineering, much bigger than just having like a media style company like a Disney. And the private equity fits in with that. I mean, we're now dealing with assets that are worth $8, $10 billion. These aren't clubs anymore. They're franchises in name. These are big assets. And frankly, each team has its own media, bills.com or whatever, you know, video they're producing. And that's interesting. I was trying to spell it out in my head, like, where's this all going? And now, you know, sports as an asset class is a phrase I never would have used 5 years ago. But when teams are going for $6 billion, they can't help but not be assets. And so I think that dilutes the, not the power of the owner, but the personality of the owner. You know, Josh Harris, no offense to Josh Harris, but a super wealthy guy, came from the private equity world. He's a banker. He's not a sportsman in the way that Jerry was as a former collegiate player. Al Davis was a coach for many years. You're losing a little bit of the football fabric that made the league, you know, sort of fun to cover, but also unique.
What do you think the impact of that will be going forward?
It's going to mean more money, basically, because these owners all have debts. The get-in price is high. If you're Josh Harris and you and your friends spend $6 billion, you need a return on your equity. And that just means like promoting more growth. And I give you one example, which is of top of mind now, is gambling. And, you know, John Mara in the book is the only owner I spoke to who had any reservations about the growth of gambling. And he said, I just fear, I don't know enough, but I know that it's addictive and we're going to pay the consequence. We're going to have to own this as a league. And I said, well, John, you're on the gambling committee. How can you say this? He said, well, Roger put me on that committee because I'm the one naysayer in the room. He says, if I wasn't there, they'd be going full steam ahead. So I think a lot of owners, I'm not even trying to make a judgment about whether gambling is good or bad. They see money and they see a return on equity. They see their financial future or the, you know, a way to pay off their team debt, whatever it is. And that's right in front of them. That's not international games in London. You know, that's frankly still a money loser. It's a long-term play, but gambling's right here. And so I think, to your point, I think we're going to see a lot more, let's take the money up front. Let's be careful, but let's take the money where we can.
Well, it's interesting you bring that, because I think in your book you mentioned that Paul Tagliabue actually prohibited the city of Las Vegas from advertising in NFL games in 2003, right?
Yes.
Well, look at us now. We have an NFL team in Las Vegas. We have, you know, Super Bowls in Las Vegas.
Yep.
And, you know, and we can go down this path too. I am in the belief that gambling, both fantasy and online, have really contributed to the TV ratings for the sport.
Well, so you brought up TV, which is a good segue, I think, because fans are already complaining about, wait, I have to buy Peacock or I have to get a subscription to Netflix or whatever. And you're going to, the NFL, again, is not alone in this. They're looking for new sources of revenue and also, frankly, viewers. I mean, younger viewers just don't get cable packages like people of my generation do. But that's where the money is. I mean, if you're the NFL, you're almost derelict if you don't talk to Netflix, Amazon, and Google. They want in. And they're trying to find a balance between making sure there's broad reach, that games are all on CBS or Fox, some over-the-air channel. But they also want to carve out space for these new entrants. And then, you know, let's bring it back to Buffalo. You know, you got a new stadium. Those private seat licenses are pricing out fans who have been with the team for generations. And that comes at a cost. Like, you know, there's only so many corporate clients that are going to take your seats. The emotion in the stadium is going to, I know it's a subtle issue, but the emotion is going to be different. The tailgating is going to be different. If we're all going for the Chardonnay and shrimp crowd instead of the beer and brat crowd, you know, that's just going to change the game, the dynamic of the game. Again, it's not going to matter. 97% of NFL fans never go to a game. But that's going to be more of a luxury item in a way that it certainly wasn't in Buffalo for many years.
Was there a point, Ken, where NFL owners needed to make, or the league itself, the commissioner and the commissioner's staff, whoever the commissioner was at the time, had to make a choice between providing a great TV product, an in-stadium product that was not only great, but affordable and accessible to families? Was that an either or?
No, I think, well, first of all, TV's been part of the NFL for 60 years now, 60 plus years. So they've grown together. So we had a shift in stadiums. You know, in the 70s and 80s, most teams played in municipally built stadiums. They were tenants. The money they took out was mostly in beer, food, and ticket sales. They didn't generally have a ton of suite revenue. And then Wayne Huizenga, the owner of the Dolphins, well, Joe Robbie before him, but when the Dolphins built their stadium in 90, 91, somewhere in there, they were the first team to really go all in on suites. And there was a carve out. If you built suites, you could keep the owner, you could keep the revenue. You didn't have to share it with the other owners. So suddenly, wait, I want a stadium like that too, because I'm going to keep, say, 30% of the revenue. I'm not going to share that with the other owners. And that led to a whole building boom. The other problem the NFL often had, not in Buffalo, but in other cities, was you shared with baseball, which made scheduling horrible. You had to block out games for potential NFL or MLB playoffs. So if you were the Eagles playing in with the Phillies and the Phillies were in the playoffs, you had to juggle schedules. It was a bit of a nightmare for the league. So that building boom started in the 90s, and Jerry Richardson was the first in Carolina to add PSLs. Again, all the other owners saw that. We can charge fans to help us build the stadium. I hadn't thought of that one before. Now everybody's doing PSLs, and they're only getting more outrageous. And so every owner copies that. You know, whenever it comes to revenue, they're all copying each other for how else can we extract money from loyal fans.
Yeah, Ken, as we start to wrap up this conversation, I did want to talk international because you mentioned, I thought you mentioned the international games right now are a money loser for the league.
Yes.
So what is the league's goal? Are we talking teams in Europe? Are we talking more games? And not just Europe, internationally. Right. What are you seeing in the crystal ball there?
One thing that came out of writing the book that sort of became very apparent was the NFL is very deliberate. I mean, I guess I sort of knew this beforehand, but it became very apparent. If you think back, the first regular season NFL game was in 2007 at Wembley, and they went like took baby steps, both in terms of the number of games and the number of countries. Then they got Tottenham. Then they played back-to-back games, or the Jacksonville stayed for 2 weeks. Then they moved to these other countries, Germany and so forth. It's a long-term play. Part of it's driven by demographics, basically a American population that's not growing very fast. And we're sort of at saturation, right? When you have 90 out of the top 100 games are football games, you know, how many more are you going to get, right? So going overseas was never like a quick fix for anything. I said money losing. The Kansas City Chiefs, the president, Mark Donovan, told me maybe a year ago, he said they made 1.5 million euro in sponsorships in Germany in 2024. And I said, wow, that's great. You're getting traction. He said, yeah, but we spent 3 million on marketing. And that's the Chiefs, right? I mean, they're popular. They played a game in Frankfurt. I mean, we're not talking about the Panthers or some other team. So you got to spend a lot of money to make money. So this is a long-term play, and that's just one team. As for teams overseas, I say the simple math is I doubt there's going to be an NFL team. There could be a separate kind of like what the NBA is doing with a separate league. The issue, there's multiple issues, but the main issue is every time you add an NFL team, you dilute the share that the other owners get. So if you're dividing everything 1/32nd, now it's going to be 1/33rd. So the entry price for the new team is going to have to offset that loss of revenue. So now you're talking like billions in expansion fees. Then you got the stadium, then you got to outfit the team. And so who's going to have that money? I mean, the Saudis, maybe. It's just going to be such an expensive enterprise to do. So I just don't see it. Then you have the logistics issues. You're playing in London, minding your own business, and a middle linebacker gets injured. Well, now I need a replacement. Well, guess what? All the free agent middle linebackers are in Arizona right now working out. How are you going to put them on a plane to go to London? for a tryout, not even to make the team. So you're going to, there's just like a lot of logistics that make it very hard to contemplate, at least now. One owner said, you know, once we get supersonic jets and somebody could get to London in 4 hours, then maybe it's going to work. But mm-hmm. we're away from that. I have no expertise in aviation.
Yeah. Ken, there's one question I really want to, you know, get into before we wrap up with you. And, you know, and your book is Every Day is Sunday. And part of that is football is played on every other day but Sunday, it seems nowadays. Maybe what you've heard in the room talking to the owners is there any worry about kind of diluting this great spectacle? Because the beauty of the NFL, and I've worked in the NHL and the NBA, and we played way too many games, was every yeah. game wasn't special. Is there any concern as you go to 18, 19, who knows how many games, that really we're just diluting what we had, which was the special day and the special sport?
Yeah, Paul Tagliabue, I don't know if he said it in the book, or he certainly said it to me several times, NFL, through dumb luck, has benefited from scarcity demand. There's just only so many weeks we can have players play. And yeah, they'll try and add an 18th game and drop a preseason. But the reality is the star players never play in the preseason anyway. So they're going to want another bye week. So now you're out into like President's Day weekend for the Super Bowl. There's not that much more window physically that they can tax the players. They're going to have to expand the rosters. That's going to get more expensive. And the players are going to resist. I mean, they're not going to just say, sure, let's add another game. It's their bodies on the line. I don't think we're going to get to Tuesday night football and Wednesday night football. I just don't think it's physically possible to keep doing it at this level. And I don't watch a ton of college, but I turn on TV on Wednesday and I'm watching Boise State against, you know, you name it. And they've muddied it to the point where the conferences don't matter. And I don't think the NFL wants to go down that path. I think they've got a really nice number of 32 teams, 8 divisions of 4. Geographically, they're spread out nicely. I don't see what the rush is to add a ton more. 18th game makes sense, mostly because it'll allow them to play more international games and then sell international TV packages.
Right.
But I know Mark Cuban a bunch of years ago said the NFL was getting greedy. I just don't see it. I don't see it to the fear that he expressed. I think the NFL is very aware of this problem. And 18, I suspect. I mean, look, the NFL used to have 12 games and then it stayed there forever. Then it went to 14 for 20, 30 years. And then it went to 16 and now 17 and 18. You could add a playoff round maybe, but I just don't see it saturating in that sense.
Yeah, I agree. And you take a look at even now, even when there were 16 games, a lot of times those last 2-3 games were somewhat meaningless, and you would have players sit, they would be getting ready for the playoffs. And if you add more games, quite frankly, I just think there's going to be more games that are not marquee, and ultimately then you're going to dilute your viewership. So I think it's a slippery slope that the league really needs to stay focused on.
Yeah, well, to my point about it being deliberate, I mean, I think they definitely want to get to 18. It's also a round number, so you're not going to have like 7 and 10 seasons. You know, you'll have even numbers again. Right. And that this international is something they're really focused on. But, you know, beyond 18, I don't know, maybe not.
Yeah.
I don't know how long I'm going to live, but I probably won't be around for 20. I'd be surprised.
Hey, before we head out of here, Ken, you mentioned international. I'm going to slide right back over to that. Real quick, the NFL in Toronto, what do you see happening or not happening there?
Well, I did write about the experiment the Bills had years ago. I spent a month one night at the Big Tree Inn and talked to fans who were fearful the Bills were going to lose or leave town. Toronto is an odd market. It's got a ton of money, great sponsorship opportunities. It doesn't really have a stadium, an NFL-ready stadium. The Rogers Centre isn't it. So I don't know what they want to do there. And then, of course, you got the Argos and the CFL. So the other thing is, you guys know better than me, is I think that Canadian fans love coming to Buffalo. They love the tailgating. They love buying a case of beer at duty free on the way over. I just don't think I'm not sure the Bills, that moment when the Bills were experimenting proved that it really wasn't an NFL market, or at least currently. And the Bills, of course, are just building a new stadium, so they're not going to leave. So if there's an expansion, and we talked about it earlier, my guess is it would be Mexico City and Toronto would be the two teams to enter, because you wouldn't have to worry about time zones, and the legal systems are similar, and Mexico City is close to Arizona and Texas, and so maybe there'll be an expansion team there, but not with that current stadium.
Ken, over the next several weeks, you're on a bit of a book tour. Let us know where you're going to be. We know you're coming to Buffalo, so tell us about Buffalo and the other cities you'll be hitting.
Yeah, I'll be in Chicago at the end of this week, first week in November. Then I'll be in Norfolk, Virginia, at Old Dominion. Then I head up to Buffalo. Looking forward to that. Buffalo beer and books, doesn't get any better. And then speaking at the Baldy Center on campus. And then I'll be out in Portland, Oregon, and then New Orleans. They have a group called the Touchdown Club that's hosting me there in New Orleans. And then I'll take a breather, and then it'll be playoff time.
Well, that sounds great. It's quite the road trip, quite the tour. It's like fun nights.
All right. Well, Ken Belson, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Every Day is Sunday.
Yeah, no, thank you, guys. That was great.
And we'll be right back on Skin in the Game.
Catch up on the latest from Buffalo Toronto Public Media on our YouTube channel. While you're there, don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an update.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game. And again, thank you to Ken Belson, the author of Every Day is Sunday. Tim, we actually could have probably done this as a 3-episode interview.
Well, first, he's a writer. So, I mean, you know, every time, John, we have an author on Skin in the Game, I go to town. I resisted too many writing questions. But yeah, I mean, this is a topic. I mean, you and I both have so much interest in sort of people out there. But I mean, this book is rich with insights, not only on the owners, the commissioners, Goodell, Paul Tagliabue, Pete Rozelle before both of those guys, but the staffs too. And I mean, you've been big league sports executive. There's layers and layers.
Well, that's why I was surprised, and I guess pleasantly surprised, that Ken got kind of pulled into the tent, because you know, so often the owners are very, very protective of what he said, she said, they said, you know, kind of they're really kind of confidential in that way. So credit to Ken for having built the confidence, you know, in among those owners to really get an inside look and really a deep look at the makings of the NFL.
Thinking of this as a journalist too, appealing, and this is an authentic appeal, but appealing to people's, you know, sense of legacy, their sense of relevance, their sense of, you know, cementing and their place in history, making sure their voice is part of it. That is, in the truest, most honest way, that is a great way to connect with people. But I imagine for the executives who work for those owners too, and that's really where you get into a lot of these details.
Right. I absolutely love the analogy of the high school cafeteria. You could almost see it, right? And it'd be funny if there were like a South Park or some animated way to recreate this, but you've got the cool kids, and it sounds like all the cool kids have the Super Bowl rings, right? You might have the new kids who are trying to figure out how they become the cool kids. And then you have the rebels, right? You know, they're wearing the leather jackets, or in the back of the room, they're firing the spitballs, starting the food fights. And obviously that's Al Davis and a few of his rebel crew. But a really fun analogy. You could see how just where the owners sit in the room and the cliques that they form, how sometimes decisions are made.
Did I ever tell you the story of me stumbling into an NFL owners meeting?
No.
Okay, well,
were you the cool kid?
I was the kid who wasn't. I was a kid from another school school. No, what happened was at the old Waldorf Astoria in New York. I was there on behalf of the Buffalo News, writing a story on a guy named Tom Barnett, a custom clothier from Buffalo, who sold $20,000 suits out of the Waldorf. And we happened to be at the Waldorf on the day of the NFL owner meetings. And so Tom took me on a tour of the Waldorf, and he just walked straight past security and straight into the NFL owner meetings. And I have no words for how strongly I can emphasize that does not happen. You do not do that. But he was wearing a $20,000 suit. He talked and walked like he belonged. We walked in there, and, you know, in the book, Ken describes the tables in the shape of a couple of E's, and, you know, the commissioner and his staff had a dais up front. That's exactly what we walked in on. We stayed for about 30 seconds before security took a look at us and I took a look at security and I elbowed Tom and said, we should get out of here. But I can tell you, I mean, it's the nicest high school cafeteria you'll see.
I bet it is.
But that is how these men and women relate to each other. Yeah. And you've got the bullies, you've got it all.
Yeah. Well, and just to kind of wrap up that conversation with Ken, it was also, I think he and I agree that, you know, at some point enough is enough. And, you know, maybe that 18-game schedule, which is a rounder number than 17, is the right number. You know, I do think, and hopefully there are folks at the league office saying, okay, at what point are we just cannibalizing ourselves? Because, you know, having that marquee day that you can own, which was Sunday, having, you know, a limited, you know, supply and demand is beneficial. Because if you just get, you know, you get too far over your skis, and then again, once that ship sails, you can't go back.
Right. And, you know, another way to look at this too is the NFL owns pretty much every month of the year, except for June. June's the one month where you'll see little to nothing happening in the National Football League. But the combine, right. The NFL combine, that, you know, where the college players come in and get evaluated by scouts, that's a big deal. Well, the draft used to be just a draft, right. And now it's a massive event.
Well, if you go back to our interview with Frank Sapovitz and Skin in the Game months back, yeah, he talked about how the draft was 12 people sitting around with cigars and, you know, and then they've turned that now into, you know, close to a million visitors visit a city for an NFL draft. So, you know, you're right. They've created other content, other programming beyond the games. And I think that's really important. And, you know, it helps build their brand without sacrificing the health of the players playing another game.
And Every Day is Sunday, Ken Belson's book, is such a great study into how that all happened. And again, it marries the characters with, you know, with those turning points from Rupert Murdoch's and Fox getting the TV rights and everything that, you know, that catalyzed, you know, down to, again, how the draft and the combine became such a big deal. John, I think we should let people know where they can see Ken Belson out on the road.
Please do.
So we have a list here, and as a PSA, I'll tell everybody listening out there, go online and check this out, because there will be more dates since, you know, the time we record this. But November 13th, he'll be in Buffalo, New York at a restaurant called The Place for Buffalo Beer and Books. November 14th, he'll be at the University at Buffalo with the Law School, doing an on-stage event there. And then November 15th at Talking Leaves Buffalo. That's a bookstore in Buffalo. December 1 to 30 is going to be in Portland, Oregon. And Ken mentioned a few other places that are in the works as well. So if you are a would-be reader out there and you want to go get a book signed, meet Ken, ask him some questions like we did, go grab a copy of Every Day is Sunday and say hey to Ken out on the road.
And thank again to Ken for joining us. And thank you to all of you for listening to Skin in the Game. Until next time. This is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thanks for listening.